Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the why and how of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today, we are pleased to have with us Space Nuclear Power Company Chief Technology Officer and co-founder, Dr. David Poston. The Space Nuclear Power Company, also known as Space Nukes, has a goal of facilitating the use of fission reactors in space. Dr. Poston, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks. I'm very glad to be here.
I want to start off our conversation with a quote you have at the top of your website. Can you please tell us about Admiral Rickover's 1953 quote about academic versus practical nuclear reactors and why it's relevant today?
Yeah, I love that question because back then, you know, he is really the godfather of special purpose nuclear reactors. In fact, the only person successful in the United States to ever develop a functioning, useful special purpose reactor. And those are all the reactors in aircraft carriers and submarines that the Navy uses. And he learned as he went along that there's always people out there selling really fancy reactors that can, you know, get you to Mars and back in 10 days, you know, and for no mass. But they're always on paper. I tend to refer to them paper reactors or PowerPoint reactors is the new term. But, you know, it's like, but academic reactor, the same thing. I mean, they were using mostly equations. So he saw this and he saw that not only can they promise to do great things, decision makers are more likely to listen to them because they tell a good story.
Yeah.
And they don't really have to go into the details. And I see that today in just people selling reactor programs to like venture capitalists. You know, it's like they tell a great story, but there's not much real behind the system. And so Rickover understood that once you start building and testing actual reactors, they look a whole lot different than they do when you're selling them how they look on paper.
And we're actually going to talk a lot in this conversation about why there hasn't been more progress and, you know, how that sort of challenge still applies. But let's now actually transition to start things off to learn a little bit more about, you know, space nukes technology, what you've got and what the initial applications have been or that you're developing.
Yeah, so Space Nukes is focused on near-term real reactors, going back to Rickover. There's a market for those in a few areas. There's NASA deep space science, right? They're limited to very, very small power levels. And they've done an unbelievable job getting solar to work for a mission to Jupiter, which they should be applauded for.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to get enough power out there, and going even further out is nearly impossible. And the other thing they'll do for deep space science is really electric propulsion. So you use the electricity from the reactor to power ion thrusters or other kind of thrusters, and you can now go into orbit of these moons, whether it's Enceladus or Triton or Titan or Europa, and actually do some real science. You know how great that Pluto mission was recently. They only had like 45 minutes to record data, right? Because they're zooming by.
Yeah. Right?
So there's only so much you can do. And they only had so much power to beam data back. So that's one is being able to study all the places in the solar system we're interested in and beyond for extended periods and send enough data back with enough power. The other near-term application are surface power missions for either the moon or Mars. Right now, both commercially and at NASA, the focus is on the moon, right?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, even though the moon is closer to the sun, it's actually harder for solar power because of the 14 Earth days worth of darkness, right?
Yep.
And it gets incredibly cold. So the solar panels could produce the power, but to be able to store that at very cold temperatures for 14 days is harder than a reactor. You know, so it's really, the reactor makes a ton of sense there. And especially the water we look at is down in craters. You know, you can put your power down there. And then on Mars, the story is dust storms, right? It's already a diminished solar insulation is what we call it. You know, the actual watts per square meter that you can get. is down. But the dust storms make it to the point where if you have to have a system that can sort of give you the power you need during dust storms, it becomes impractical. So Mars is also a great candidate for surface power. And then the last thing is there's a lot of heating up in what we call cislunar space from the defense perspective. China is really aggressive right now. And so nuclear systems can give us capabilities that are far superior in a lot of ways. And that's one of the projects we're working on now. And, you know, it gets into some classified areas, but nothing at this point.
Can you say actually a little more about, at a high level about that? Obviously, you have to protect, you know, national secrets, but, you know, certainly there is a competition happening around satellites. They're talking about developing nuclear systems. What exactly does nuclear allow, you know, in cislunar that you can't accomplish otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, one is mobility, right? You want to have your satellite assets maybe moved to a different location to see what's going on somewhere, or to maybe eventually physically inhibit something.
Maneuver without regret, I guess, is the
That's right. Yeah, and maneuver without regret. You've been studying because it's...
I'm trying.
Because you only can carry so much propellant. And it's every move you take, you're losing a lot of your capability. With nuclear, we can go to much higher, what we call specific impulse, which is how much thrust you get per kilogram propellant. Mm-hmm. So you use a much smaller fraction of your propellant with the nuclear systems. And, you know, it really, a lot of it comes down to, it's still the high ground that matters, but instead of being a hill like during a battlefield, if you can be above everyone else, have enough power to see everything and see what's going on down below you, that's another aspect where nuclear can give you that kind of power to do that.
And does the additional power matter as well, or is that not as important?
Okay. Yes, it does. I mean, you know, power is important for whatever level and what kind of information you're trying to extract. You know, if it's a radar or if potentially launch a signal to jam somebody else's spacecraft, you know, spacecraft communications. So in a lot of those, in the more what you call offensive, even though we'd only use them as defensive measures, capabilities, power can become very important.
Right. So that's another application. And I guess, you know, what does space nukes have right now? Is it mainly the brilliance of the team? Is it IP? I was looking through your website. Yeah. I'm just trying to make sure I understand correctly.
I would say it's all of the above, but what we've got that's tangible is the only reactor technology that's been tested, that's being proposed. Every other company out there is proposing reactors that have never been tested, reactor types. And so our kilopower test, our Krusty test, demonstrated this reactor. And so we're a full step ahead in the game. In fact, the hardest step in the game, because testing something on the Earth is difficult and expensive, because we have to worry more about safety when we test it down here than we do when there's nobody around it up in space. So we've gotten over the hard hurdle. And so our technology is ready to fly.
And so you're saying you're sort of ahead of everyone else for a reactor that can be used in space. It's not necessarily, okay.
Yeah, our reactor makes no sense to use on the ground unless you're really, there might be some niche applications, maybe in the ocean where you'd want a low power. But when you're talking tens to hundreds of kilowatts, you know, that's not the kind of a thing that we easily can't get either with solar power, wind power, or taking diesel fuel, to our location.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit, how did space nukes get started?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the term space nukes has been around since the 90s, because that's what we called their softball team at Los Alamos. And so we have space nukes jerseys.
I love it.
Go back 25 years, right?
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's been my passion since then, right? And we were a team that was working on nuclear power for space. And so that term's been around a long time. Now the team was you know, kind of cruising along at Los Alamos, and we got this big test done. But then the Department of Energy, there was kind of a shift in the direction they wanted to go in NASA. And at that point, we felt they had lost their way on the direction we thought they should go, and we were losing influence. So that's when we decided to form our own company, because we thought that was the best chance to actually get a reactor flown in space.
And so you guys are a bunch of, I mean, is it civil servants?
No, some of us are civil servants. I mean, right. It's gone now, that worked at NASA. At Los Alamos, we're government contractors.
Right, yeah.
They've never been civil servants at Los Alamos.
But you are sort of surrogate civil servant. I've worked for the federal government.
We're getting money from the same pot, right?
So, right. And then you decide you don't agree with the direction that sort of leadership is taking from a technical perspective. Yeah. So you split off. And then how do you get money? How do you convince your wife that you're not going to be impoverished?
We were probably a little naive early on that the money would come. Of course, we're the only people that have built a reactor. But, in that world, that's with all these people that are out there promising things, like Riverwalk said, it's hard to get funding. And we were very lucky. Our CEO, Andy Phelps, has worked on huge programs at Bechtel and elsewhere throughout his career, and really understands the business part. And without him, I don't think we would have ever gotten to where we are now. So and he wasn't part of that core engineering group. He did work at Los Alamos, and we'd run into him before. But without him, we would not be where we are today.
And let's, is there for the company NVIDIA, there's like a mythic meeting that takes place at a Denny's where everybody agrees, we're going to do this. Was there a moment or a meeting where you all decided, we're going to take this risk and we're going to do it? Or did you wait till the money was there? How did you make that
transition? No, we definitely did it before the money was there. But we, it was a little gradual, but, we were all sitting around, kind of depressed about where things were going. In our careers, we're all on the point where we maybe have 10 good years left, or 15 or 20, whatever you say. It's like, if we really want to make a difference, we can't wait any longer. And we're going to have to try to push it as much as we can from the commercial side.
And what does that mean to push it from the commercial side? Because for the foreseeable future, the government is going to be probably the customer for this, right?
Probably, yes. We can get into Elon Musk a little later because we have talked with him a little bit. But the government is still the place to get money for these kind of projects, and that's how we're funded right now.
Get government contracts now, and that's your it's not a VC backed effort.
No, we are ongoing discussions always with VCs. And we generally think we're worth more than they're going to give us. Which is to our credit so far. We're bringing in contracts and we haven't diluted our company at all. So it's still just us founders or the owners. And I think that's really helping us right now. I mean, to go back to why we thought we could be successful commercially, I think, despite it always gets me in trouble, but I said it when I worked in the lab, most government programs are as much job programs as they are to get things done.
Yeah.
And especially in national labs and NASA centers, right? And so when we even ran projects there, we had a hard time telling somebody, no, we can't have that person work on this project, but we want this person. And so having control of the actual money and how it's spent is extremely important to try to get something done.
And I don't know if you are willing to talk about this, but I mean, do you think sort of the national laboratory model is a bit broken, or you know, is that just the only way politically this could ever get done? How do you think about, I guess one of my questions later on is, you know, what do you think could be done to accelerate the development of these systems? Because I think a lot of people are frustrated by the pace. Or yes. Conversely, you know, we've been talking about this since the Kennedy administration.
Exactly.
You know, why don't we already have this, and what can be done to make it go faster?
Right. And that is part of the problem. I think, you know, we totally believe in the Skunk Works model, which was a Lockheed Martin thing, if you know, in terms of trying to keep the team small and focused on success. But it's been, you know, in the government, it's just harder to do that. And, you know, but, you know, I would say broken, but being mended. NASA's really done a good job, I think, over the last 10 years, starting to do what they call, you know, public-private partnerships, the CLPS program, which Intuitive Machines used, you know, and, you know, what they've gotten from their investment in SpaceX is, you know, astounding relative to everything else. So I think from the NASA perspective, they're really improving from that perspective. So I'll give them some credit for that.
So as we move away from the national laboratory model, we're getting success. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who would agree with that. The challenge here in the nuclear space, which, you know, many people are passionate about, is, of course, the proliferation risk makes it a lot harder for them to let go.
Yes.
Make it more commercial. Do you think there's a way? I mean, you know, is it, you know, just if companies can demonstrate they meet certain standards, they don't have to go through all of this? Or how would we change the dynamics in the nuclear space to go from sort of the older distributed national laboratory model to something more akin to what you're talking about with CLPS, with SpaceX, and things like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, well, first order, you know, fear of radiation is still totally irrational, right? I mean, it's despite all the education we try to do, people view radiation as it's like 100 times more dangerous than it really is relative to everything else, right? It's like we require two more zeros on all our safety probabilities. You know, and that's a good place to start. I don't think the regulations and regulators themselves aren't as much a problem, except that they're afraid to do something that the public will have outcry to because of their fear of radiation, which kind of paralyzes them from making decisions. So what we did on Krusty, we haven't even talked about Krusty yet.
But let's get to that. Let's go there now.
Okay, so you know, this was our reactor test, and we had a lot of people tell us you'll never get it through all the approval processes, right? And so Patrick McClure, who is our safety expert, what we did is instead of the traditional NRC model, which I think they can learn from, is basically they need to verify every calculation we do. Is kind of the way people looks at it. And the reason that's a bad idea, because the guys who design the system know everything about it and have the codes to do it. And to try to have somebody else develop those codes independently is a bigger project than just the rest of the project itself for the guys doing the system.
And sorry to interrupt, can you just say for the what is Krusty? What were you trying to accomplish there?
All right, so Krusty, kilopower reactor using Stirling technology. And it is a Simpsons reference. We haven't gotten that out of there. I've got, you know, our first test was the Duff test. And then
From beer to clowns.
For Krusty, we literally had a high up NASA official at a meeting say, we're not naming our reactor after a drunk cigarette smoking clown. He said this. We all sat there quietly. But it was already in like the official paperwork. And so it was like
too late.
I know. It is. It was like Monty Burns was sitting there twiddling his fingers. You know, it's like, and I do have a cone called Monty Burns. I got cones called Maggie and Mr. Plow and Homer. So it's in the public and the press love it. After we did Krusty, everyone would show, like, you know, pictures of Duff and Krusty. And I think, you know, we don't mind taking risks from a PR perspective. Obviously, the name Space Nukes, right? A lot of people told us, don't do that. I like getting it out on the table, you know, instead of trying to, you know, tiptoe around an issue. You know, and it still might be a bad idea to call ourselves Space Nukes, but that's what we do.
People remember the name. I mean, you don't forget Space Nukes.
So Krusty was a test of a kilopower reactor. And a kilopower reactor is like the name, it's like 1 to 10 kilowatts of electrical power, right? Which isn't a huge amount, but for a spacecraft, it is a huge amount because we're used to trying to live on a few hundred watts on most spacecraft. Yeah. And so it's kind of the next step. And it actually came from John Cassani, who is like the hero of all project managers at NASA, right? He led the Voyager, Galileo, some of the Viking and Cassini missions, you know, mm-hmm. So he knows how to get stuff done, right? And we're huge fans of him. And he said, well, we need some reactors to make up for our dwindling plutonium-238 supply. Mm-hmm. If we're ever going to do deep space science, you know, because the radioisotope systems are what they use, but they're really limited and we're almost out of it. So it's really a win-win to get a reactor that gives us more power. And we have a lot more uranium, way more uranium than we do plutonium-238. So it was a reactor to do that. But that project fizzled away. And then we were sitting around at our desks in Los Alamos, you know, again, kind of depressed, like it sounds depressing career. You know, our careers are a failure, not getting anything done. And we really set our minds to what's the easiest thing we could do to actually show we can do anything real in nuclear anymore. And that was the mm-hmm. Duff test, demonstration using flat top fissions. And we were able to get NASA people to come out there and they said, oh, this is cool. You know, and so we only made like, you know, like 20 watts. I mean, it was incredibly small, but it was something with nuclear power. And so then they said, what can you do next? And that's when we came up with Krusty and convinced them to do that. So we tested in this case, a 1 kilowatt electric reactor that produces 5 kilowatts of thermal power. And you have to convert that to electricity at a specific, in this case, a 20% system efficiency. And that's the test we did to demonstrate a lot of cool aspects about the reactor, which we might get to next. But I know I've been talking a lot, but going back to your original question, how we got it approved, right, was mm-hmm. we brought the regulator in from day one and said, this is what we're going to do. This is the next step we're going to take, and this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then we bring them in and show them that's what happened. So we do electrical heated tests saying, oh, watch, our fuel temperature is going to go to this. You know, and our reflector temperature is going to go to this level. And they would see that and gain some confidence in us and say, okay, what's next? Up to the point where we were at the point as we were testing with nuclear power that we still had to predict what's this test going to look like. Mm-hmm. And there were three of these tests. And if none of them went the way we said they would, we would be shut down from a safety basis. Mm-hmm. So we put faith in that we could predict the system. And by the way, it's really because it was designed to be simple. I mean, we're good modelers, but partially it just makes the system easy enough you can model it. So like the night before the last pre-test, I'd say, I had to text out to the Department of Energy and the rest of the staff, you know, what the peak temperature is going to be of the specific thermocouple on this test. And I had to get it within like 10%. And we did, and we got that, gave us approval to the next step. So we got the regulator to go with this method of trust but verify every step along the way. We'll show you it's mm-hmm. safe, show you we know what we're doing, instead of them trying to match our predictions with models that they didn't have.
Right. And so in some ways, you were telling them what you thought the procedure should be, rather than waiting for them to tell you what you should do. And that's how you created a pathway sort of through the bureaucracy, it sounds like.
Yes, it was. And they were literally, you know, and you're not supposed to say this about the regulator, I guess, in the current world, but they were like our buddies. They were awesome. They wanted this to work. They were as invested in getting something real done as we were, because they were kind of tired of just being known as the people that always say no, right?
Right.
And so, I don't know, I've never really dealt much with the NRC, but this was the Department of Energy was our regulator. Any test done on Department of Energy land. But they all follow about the same procedures, and there's nothing that says the NRC couldn't do it the same way.
Right. And so, you know, as you alluded to, what are some of the things that are special about this technology pathway that you're working on?
All right. Well, the most novel thing and best thing about it is it uses heat pipes to cool the reactor. You know, the heat pipe is basically a closed tube with a two-phase fluid in it. And you put in heat at one end, that fluid boils. Mm-hmm. And when it boils, it builds up vapor pressure and drives the hot vapor down to what we call the condenser end of the heat pipe, which is a little colder, and it condenses there and it gives up all its energy due to its phase change at the condenser end. And then the hard part is getting the fluid back to the evaporator to get a closed loop. And in gravity, you can just use gravity. It's called a thermal siphon. Technically, in a heat pipe, you have a capillary wick, just like a wick in a candle, where it uses the capillary forces of the fluid to draw it back down to the hot end, evaporate. So you have a closed loop of two-phase liquid metal, in our case, heat transfer, which is about as good a heat transfer as you could ever get. I mean, take copper, the thermal conductivity of copper, and multiply it times 1,000. I mean, it almost instantly moves heat along its length, and which our tests also showed it did. And so that I would say that's the biggest aspect of the test and the reactor that's unique.
That's right. And, you know, what are you hoping, you know, to accomplish with the path that you're on in the next, you know, 5 years and then 10 years out?
So we hope to have a reactor in space in about 4 years. And that's the Jetson program is one we're working on now with the Air Force Research Lab and the Space mm-hmm. Force. We're a subcontractor to Lockheed Martin. They're doing the spacecraft and the thrusters and everything. But this is to demonstrate electric propulsion in about the 10 kilowatt range. Mm-hmm. So that's really the near-term vision. The other is the fission surface power program. NASA's working on that. We're not currently part of that project. They wanted to go to a different technology. That's really kind of one of the reasons we left. They like what we call moderated reactors better. It really is those two things. And then we think as soon as we get NEP or space reactor demonstrated, NASA is going to love to buy one to do some deep space science. And so that's where we want to go from there. And then, of course, you know, the commercial economy on the moon, you know, if it grows, people are going to need power. I mean, it's like everyone can't do 14-day missions Well, maybe they can, but, you know, like the ones we do now where you land and then when the sun goes down, you're done. I mean, so to do a sustained presence, we see that. And, you know, that could be commercial. There's a chance that's not NASA. And you know, Elon, when we talked with him, you know, we came close to, you know, him getting excited about building his own reactors, but he really wanted to stay focused on, you know, the transportation issue, right? Which is still the hardest one from a whole infrastructure perspective, and hoped that somebody else would solve the power system. But I firmly believe if he gets Starship fully functional, he'll probably move on to power next, because that's,
He certainly knows something about power.
He does. And he knows nuclear. The first time we sat down to talk was funny. The first time we sat down to talk, he said, "Well, I own a solar power company, so I'm going to do all I can to make it solar." you know, even though he's still kind of understood, he's a physicist. He's brilliant. I mean, I'm a big fan of the guy. But you know, by the end, you know, he realizes if we're going to do actually get a sustained presence of people there, we're going to need reactors.
Yeah. And that's a nice segue. I did want to ask, you know, how do you think the current space nuclear programs of record, I mean, you talked about FSP, Jetson, there's also Draco, you know, how do you think that's going and what do you think is going to happen afterwards? Because these, some of them are quite short program lives.
I'm on record within the Draco project, and I've worked on it a lot, of saying this is a step too far. But they are greatly simplifying their objectives. NTP, it's really hard to convey how hard nuclear thermal propulsion is, except history does it for us. Rover Nerva did 19 different ground tests of NTP systems at a cost of well over $10 billion in today's dollars and never got close. So now,
and what's your interpretation? Is it just it's freaking hard, or like why don't we have this?
It's way harder than it's like orders of magnitude harder than any reactor we've ever built.
But let me, I'm sorry, this is just something like I'm really interested in, because there's the National Academy's study that said actually for, and maybe it's because what it was focused on, for transport, human transportation to Mars, we should focus on NTP because there is less technical risk for it. Now, I don't know if I'm not qualified to agree or disagree, actually, but that's what they said.
I was at that meeting basically when they were trying to devise that strategy, and the NASA NTP program manager said, you know, I haven't heard anybody doubt that we can do this. And I raised my hand and said, I do. I was the only person who did. So nobody believes me, of course. Why would you believe me instead of 50 other experts? So, I mean, and that still can be true. I don't blame anybody for doing it. But if you read the history of how hard it is, not only, I mean, to run a reactor at, say, 800 degrees Kelvin versus 3,000 degrees Kelvin is insanely different. I mean, the material challenges are so much harder. And then you're talking about power densities, right? You take a can of Coke. You know, you're talking about putting megawatts into this can of Coke in that,
right?
You know, in normal reactors, it's kilowatts. You know, it's so, and now you're talking about cooling the reactor with hydrogen, incredibly a damaging material on a materials aspect, and it just becomes to the extent where it's so we're going to have to take really small steps to get there. And that's what they were doing in Rover Nerva. They did a great job. They did 19 tests. They were making progress. But for anybody to think we're getting NTP without tens of billions of dollars is nuts based on just historical precedent. I mean,
do we have different tools now that make things, is it, you know, we just have that much more computation for simulation. We've got additive manufacturing. Or is that not really, are those things not really game changers and we're just continuing what we did before?
I mean, additive manufacturing is going to help in some areas for sure. Computation helps a bit. But I go back, I look at the system model they used for Rover Nerva back in the 60s. I look at it, these guys knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. This is awesome. I look at everybody doing models today. They there's no realism in them. They haven't had any experience with real systems to know how stuff's going to behave. And they'll believe what the code tells them, even though they're asking the code the wrong question.
Yeah. And just to close out that NEP versus NTP. So, I mean, there's this challenge, as you say, for NTP, the systems they're talking about are megawatt class.
Yeah. But closer to gigawatt. But yeah. Hundreds of megawatts.
But you would still need actually that kind of power for human exploration applications if you were doing NEP as well. Is it easier to scale up NEP systems, or are you just saying we can do useful things with NEP systems at lower power than we can do with NTP systems, period?
Well, yeah, you only need about 10 to 20% the power for an NEP system to get a better mission than you do for NTP. So that gets you about there. The NTP, like if you look at Vasimir, if you know Franklin Chang Diaz's. He looks at megawatt, 10 to 20 megawatt reactors, right? And those are hard, but they are simpler than NTP. But to me, the biggest thing is you can develop in stages. We can develop right now an NEP system that NASA can use usefully, and it gives us the infrastructure, the knowledge to move forward to higher power systems. And that comes back to, you know, when Rick over talked about uninformed people, he wouldn't believe where we are today. Because in the 1960s, we had the Idaho National Reactor Test Site, right? And which is now Idaho National Laboratory, but it was actually just named a reactor test site. And we did hundreds of reactors. We were building and testing new reactors every week, right? And so we had expertise like you wouldn't believe. Now we've got none. And people kind of think, oh, we must have experts. Somebody calls himself an expert. But we have rocket experts, right? Because people are building and testing rockets all the time, right? And they kind of just don't, there's a big disconnect there that we don't have space reactor experts. And that's why we have to start simple. And that's what we did. And we're starting to build expertise. And that's the only way we'll get it done, in my opinion. It's always just my opinion, but I've worked in this field a long time and seen, I've been a part of failed program after failed program after failed program. And every single one of them, they promised they could do too much. And so you run out of money. It's basically, they go back to the customer saying, we need more money, need more time, more money. And it gets canceled. I mean, people will use excuses for getting program canceled all the time, right? Oh yeah, changing priority from Congress. But it's always been because they've asked for more money and their priority isn't to give them more money.
Right. So you're saying if they had actually been able to deliver on the timeline and budget they'd said, they might have been able to do it. The problem was they kept going back for more and they just
couldn't. Clearly that way. I know with the SB-100, it was definitely that way. Yeah. That program ballooned from $500 million to $3 billion. Jimmo started out at like $1 billion and quickly went to $3.5-4 billion. Yeah. And because they've promised way more than they can deliver.
I mean, I would actually say this is a challenge not just for space nuclear, but even terrestrial commercial nuclear. So, you know, escalating costs seem to be the biggest challenge for all of these systems. How do you think about containing costs to enable a real expansion of this marketplace?
Yeah, I am not a fan of small modular reactors. I think they're going to end up being less too poor in economics. Mm-hmm. I think what we were doing in the 70s was the right thing, building the big power plants. And, you know, it's hard to find investors to do that. The government should be spending all the money it's putting now into small modular reactors. Just say, here, we're going to help you build the infrastructure to build big plants because they're much more economic. Yeah. That's what the rest of the world is doing, right? I mean, the rest of the world's still building these reactors. We've decided, oh, we've got something better, which I think is based on false information.
But the challenge there is, I mean, you know, one of the nice things about small module reactors from the space lover's perspective is theoretically there should be more overlap, right? So you have to do a little less specialized work just to make your thing work for space. So do you think, I mean, small modular is really just for space and we should stop pretending there's anything common on?
Yeah, and those are actually what I call micro reactors. Generally, small modular reactors are like several tens of megawatts to a hundreds, 100, 200. Micro reactors are where we're talking in the 1 to 10 megawatt range. And we're never going to be able to, I mean, I shouldn't say never, but, you know, if Starship succeeds, the most power we could actually put on a reactor is about 5 megawatts. We've done a lot of studies with that. So I think that's where microreactors for space ends. After that, you've got a civilization that can build and assemble everything there, right? So we'll be making our own power plants on the moon and Mars instead of flying them there. But the biggest reactor we're ever going to build and launch is probably on the order of a few megawatts.
Okay, interesting. So after that, we're sort of into ISRU and sort of a whole different eco.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the good stuff. as far as why these reactors are so great. Yeah, and it's ISRU is where it's at for sure.
And what do you think, what role do you see space nuclear systems having in space science and development in the next, 10 years, 20 years, and beyond that? Paint the picture for me of how this actually rolls out and is different, both on the science side and on the settlement side.
Right. Yeah. On the science side, it's pretty easy, like I said, because you can't do anything beyond Jupiter with solar or anything meaningful, and you can't go into orbit around any body,
So if we want to discover life on Enceladus, yes, or Europa, like, you got to have nuclear is what you're saying.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you'll have a lot more power to interrogate the environment, a lot more power to send data back, and most importantly, the power and the thrust to go into orbit. So that one's pretty easy. And then obviously, if we're going to try to ever, leave the solar system, you're not doing it without incredibly high specific impulse, which nuclear could enable.
Do you think fission gets us there?
Yeah, I get rather upset when people think you need fusion or antimatter, because the energy density, the energy is all there in fission. The hard part's engineering to get what we need. And that's the same with fusion eventually, I guess if you're saying the difference between 100 years or 50 years, to Alpha Centauri, trying to get to incredible speeds, you would do better with a higher energy density. But, if you look at, the megajoules per kilogram you get, right, fission is so much higher than we're currently utilizing, that we can develop technology way better. Then fusion's like the best form of fusion's only 10 times better than fission, which is a lot.
Yeah.
But right now we're 5 orders of magnitude from even using fission properly. So that's why I think it's not really worth thinking about that. Because right now, if we had fusion 100% solved on a physics basis and knew what we're doing, we're no further ahead than we are with fission. Because you have to design the system to use it. And that's all our problem, right? The materials, the power conversion, how are you going to use it?
Okay, so on the science side, if we're going to go and do anything, Jupiter and beyond, especially if we want to go into orbit around these places, we need nuclear. How about, some of the other applications and how that rolls out?
When kilopower was going, actually, before kilopower, we worked on the fission surface power program, which is ironically the same moniker as they use now. And they were both 40 kilowatts. We, because that's what they figured they needed for the first manned mission, with a handful of astronauts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of times you can say 10 kilowatts an astronaut is kind of a number that will encompass everything, right? Their life support, their science, their day-to-day operations, And so 40 was the number. When we came up with kilopower, we said this system really optimizes at 10 kilowatts, even though we do have versions that go to 40 and higher. And it's funny, at that time, the lunar and Martian architecture leads at Johnson Space Center came to really like it because they're much more mobile. They can take it off a lander and drive it somewhere and set it up. And so they said, oh, we're just going to use 410s. This is awesome. And so that's how I envision this going. We would have 10 kilowatt units that we could just post wherever we want. We could make charging stations along, you know, to charge up rovers to shoot between outposts and pile them up. And then we eventually need a higher power system, which would be 100 kilowatts or several hundred. And then the evolution to higher powers, all we have a roadmap. But the thing I hate about roadmaps is, you know, they're going to constantly change as you learn, right? And that's right now we're rather naive on space reactors, you know, and I hate to admit it, you know, but and as we learn, we're going to figure out which directions make the most sense. Do we use this power conversion technology or that? Do we use this fuel or that? This coolant or that? And so we go up to a 100 kilowatt class system. Ideally, one, the thing that I'm the biggest proponent of is sticking to simple reactor physics, which is what kilopower is. It's a fast reactor, a compact reactor. And the physics are so simple that really what dictates the power is really if the fuel heats up, the atoms move further apart, more neutrons leak out. It's really as simple as that, and our power goes down. And it's a load following system. We didn't get into that, but one of the best benefit of the kilopower reactors is they're self-regulating passive systems. We never have to control them, even in a worst case accident system. They shut down themselves. And that's with the physics. And it was so simple that we were able to predict it for our last test, and we could predict it for the next big. Each generation, we go from 10 kilowatts to 100 kilowatts to a megawatt, to 10 megawatts. We can use the past test data to go ahead and fly a reactor without a ground test. The ground test is still the most costly and risky part of any nuclear program, and that which why kilopower is in great position, because we've already done our ground test.
Right. And what role do you think commercial industry has to play in the space nuclear systems arena?
I think a lot, just basically because of the NASA trend towards public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. People like to say that the use of low-enriched uranium makes it easier for companies, but if you have a government sponsor, the commercial company can still build and design and launch, you know, and operate an HEU, highly enriched uranium. So there's a lot of factors, but nothing is really impossible from the policy perspective for companies to do what people maybe in the past that only thought the government could do.
I mean, do you think that sort of the philosophy of HEU only being owned by government is still the right approach, or, you know, would changing that unlock a lot of things without significantly increasing proliferation risk?
I don't think it would. I don't think we need to change it. They still technically would own the fuel. Like I said, we would be borrowing the fuel and never returning it in the case of it going out to space. We would never own it. So I don't think that really would change that much. It's really just the question of, you know, how big of a risk proliferation is. We have, you know, all the protections in place in law to protect it. That doesn't mean you're always going to protect it, right? But we did, for Krusty, we did ship HEU across the country for the test. I mean, all is part of known procedures. And so it's not, I don't think the risk of it falling in the wrong hands is very high relative to anything else we do.
I mean, actually, not to get too far into science fiction, but could there be a situation where it's worth stealing your reactor to get the HEU, right? I mean, literally on the moon. Obviously, this would be a pretty sophisticated actor doing that. Yeah. All right, maybe that answers.
Because I mean, it's not that hard to enrich uranium, right? I mean, it's Iran is showing that. I mean, it's you build some centrifuge. I mean, so it's not, if somebody wants to do it, something nefarious, it's easier to do that than to go up and try to steal the reactor. It reminds me of a great comedy sketch I saw where the they got, how are we going to fake the moon landing, right? Because they're saying, how are we going to fake the moon landing? And they say, well, we'll still have to build this huge rocket to get us up to the moon. Everyone sees leave, right? Or they won't believe us. And the guy says, how much is that going to cost? Oh, about 90% of the program. So they say, well, let's just go to the moon anyway then.
Right, right. Actually, I know we sort of touched on this before, but how do you at Space Nukes think about containing costs and making sure you don't end up in the trap that you talked about earlier?
Yeah, I mean, we still will basically follow the same approach we did for Krusty. And a lot of that is leveraging what exists, right? Mm-hmm. But it's mostly simplicity. It really, keep it simple, stupid is the engineer's friend, right? The KISS principle. And I think where a lot of people get mixed up is it's not the simplest reactor design. It's mm-hmm. the simplest path through development, fabrication, safety, testing, and operation. Everyone says safety first, right? But it literally is what happens with our reactors. The first calculation I ever do is to make sure this thing won't go critical and produce reactivity if it falls in water, if it falls in the sand, any launch accident, right? Because I say that's too much of a policy risk to try to get a reactor approved that isn't demonstrated to be safe. And we do it all in a passive manner with our reactor, which is really different than everybody else, where we just put materials in the reactor such that if it, say, falls in the ocean, those materials automatically, due to their nuclear cross sections or their tendency to absorb atoms, increase their share of absorption due to the actual atomic physics of that. So we call it spectral safety, but it is what we do. And that's a big part, I think, of why we'll be successful, is we're never going to have to battle that safety thing. We still have to battle safeguards, you know, battle is pejorative for that, but then testing, right? And that's, we didn't talk about the heat pipe reactor. One of the beauties of the heat pipe reactor is the building to test with heaters, because your coolant system is all enclosed in those heat pipes, right? And you're not flowing through a plenum and big pipes where it's going to be hard to heat your core and have the core think that there's nuclear power going on. I mean, the rest of the system. So if we put heaters in where the fuel was going to be, the rest of the system can still operate exactly the same. We can test out, you know, all of the real issues, the thermal structural issues with the electrical heating, which most systems can't do. And so that simplicity in testing is another big thing. And then simplicity of operation. We don't need a real-time control system because of the simplicity of the system. We demonstrated in Krusty that the reactor just, it's like a thermostat. It will always want to stay at its temperature. And if you start removing less power, it's going to produce less power, or vice versa, and stay at the same temperature. And if you stop removing power completely, it's going to go down and stop producing power.
Right. And let's, for our final few questions, I'd like to switch gears and learn a little bit about more about you. So can you just talk about your personal journey, and how did you become interested in space, and how did you become interested in nuclear?
Cool. Yeah, no, that's good. So I'm definitely a space junkie number one, mm-hmm. Which is kind of rare in my field. I started out, I was a big science fiction fan, reading Arthur C. Clarke and Asimov and all the stuff. Mm-hmm. I was in high school and decided I wanted to go into space stuff. And so I studied mechanical engineering for my undergrad and then my master's degree. But then I was lucky enough to get a job for General Electric Nuclear, mm-hmm. working on nuclear reactors. And specifically when I was there, I worked on this SB-100 project, which was a space nuclear. And I really started to understand how important, if we're going to expand into space and become multiplanetary, we're not going to do it without nuclear. And so it became a passion from that point on, where space nuclear was where I wanted to go. And I thought I bought the right skill set for that. And I decided I would go. I actually, after I went to get a PhD in nuclear, because at Los Alamos at the time, it's less and less so now, you kind of had to get a PhD to really get in the door and do stuff. But I took a postdoc at LANL instead of a much higher paying job at GE or nuclear, just because I really wanted to do that. Right. And then it's all worked out great. But then the first 20 years of my career, again, were mostly failure because of all these projects that were failing. And it wasn't until me and the other co-founder sat down and said, what can we do to actually start making some progress and start learning again, since we lost all that, really is where my passion is.
And why do you think it's worthwhile to pursue humanity becoming a multi-planetary species? I mean, obviously I agree with you, since that's the name of the thing, but like, why is that the right use of resources? It's going to cost you know, billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Why not, spend that on relieving poverty or saving the planet or whatever?
That's the right question to ask. And I always come back to four reasons why we should do this, right? Mm-hmm. And one is just technology, right? We do learn a lot and gain a lot of technology with this program. So that's definitely not a reason in itself, right? Yeah. Even though, NASA will claim Apollo gave us ice cream.
We might be able to get ice cream in other less expensive ways.
But that's number one. And number two, is the inspiration factor. It really does, it should, and I think it still does, spark something in humans, mm-hmm. the curiosity factor and the inspiration factor. I was inspired by Apollo to come do all this stuff. And it really is, I think, one of the great reasons to do this. There's also, the knowledge and enlightenment part, right? It's not only the physical knowledge, but the aphysical knowledge, right? The metaphysical knowledge, what is our place in the universe, questions, and maybe learning more about, what's beyond the Big Bang or what caused the big, keep going in science. But the big one is, and, Elon's quotes it best, what sustain the light of consciousness, whatever it is, it's like, we are so lucky to be alive as human beings. No matter who or what our creation mechanism is. So, it's like, and we should do all we can to ensure that there's tens to hundreds to millions of generations after us that get to enjoy the same thing. Right. And so it's like, I guess you would say I'm utilitarian, and that, the number of human lives lived is kind of a, the base metric. There's also the quality of life, but, it's really, we should do all we can while we have the chance. And right now we do have the chance to try to start doing some of this stuff to ensure that many, many more humans get to live after we do.
I like that. And what is your favorite space-related work of art? That can be a book, movie, TV series, but, what are a few things that, really inspired you? You started talking about this, but if you can give things.
I did like the Foundation trilogy quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge fan of the TV series. I think Apple had one.
Yeah, Apple TV.
Yeah, but I mean, I still enjoy it just because it is this. But, I love 2001. The one that I really, really enjoy because it brings humor along, is Hitchhiker's Guide. And I love that music too. I mean, the movie too. I thought that was a fantastic movie. So yeah, it's really anything that sci-fi, gets me excited. So, I mean, I could list off a lot of stuff, but yeah.
Awesome. And just anything else you'd like to add for our audience before we break?
No, this has been great. I think we definitely need people dreaming, right? But I always kind of like to encourage a lot of young engineers to really try to stick in nuts and bolts, because it's too easy. Now it's the same way. I started out in fusion, and then my PhD was in high performance nuclear thermal rockets. And then as my career went on, I said, well, who's going to do the easy, try to just do anything. And so it's hard as an engineer not to get sucked in to try to solve the hard problems, right? Because you want to, and they're the funnest to work on. I love working on NTP, but you know, to just try to keep yourself grounded in reality on what can be done within a realistic cost and schedule in today's environment. And you know, so that's kind of what I try to tell people going to this field is, you know, I don't want to curb your enthusiasm by saying, well, we might not get that fusion drive in the next, you know, 40 years or whatever, but it's, that's the message I kind of like to spread.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Dr. Poston, for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast. And thanks to all of our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word with no dashes, at gmail.com.